12. Even for the victors, the next 3 days were not easy. By the end, Bella was removed from whatever lingering hold on command she might have retained. She was taken to one of the standard crew sleeping pods, and locked inside, without food, water, or access to shipnet. It was a day before anyone came to check that she was still alive, a day before she could ask any questions. But through the thin plastic sheet that served as a door, the ship's noisy convulsions provided a kind of news service of their own. She was close enough to the gymnasium for sounds to travel, and she listened with a quiet mammalian attentiveness, like a shrew in a hole. She heard Jim Chisholm, his voice strained with effort, desperately trying to forge some sort of reconciliation between the two shipboard factions. Because he was trusted, people were prepared to listen when he urged amity. What was done, Chisholm said. A life had been taken. Wasn't that enough blood for one ship? Let it end with Tom Crabtree. Let it end here and now. She heard Ryan Axford making similar placatory noises. Axford said he would refuse to treat anyone he believed to have perpetrated violence against another crew member. People liked and respected Axford, too, but he was a doctor with a duty of care. They wondered if he really meant it. Anyway, he wasn't the only medic on the ship. There were still doubts about Rockhopper's true situation. The big question, whether to run for home or ride Janus into the night, remained painfully unresolved. Some of Svetlana's faction were coming around to the idea that Janus was now their only hope of long-term survival, and that it would be suicide to leave the slipstream. But there were others amongst her people who still thought it was better to try to get home, no matter how unlikely their chances of survival. They still thought Earth would find a way to rescue them, even as they fell away from the sun like a stone down a well. As each hour passed, their argument became less sustainable, but that did not stop them fighting their corner, and fight they did, too. Bella heard the same frenzied arguments over and over again throughout the long hours of her confinement. They never quite boiled over, but there were times when people had to be restrained from clawing each other apart. And all the while, Janus was accelerating, and pulling Rockhopper with it. Then came Svetlana's speech. She made it over the ship-wide speaker so that everyone would hear it. Pumps and generators were set to idle. People listened wordlessly, without even a cough of interruption. "Crew of Rockhopper," she began, "we find ourselves in a situation. We didn't ask for it. We certainly didn't want it. That doesn't mean that some of us didn't anticipate it, that some of us didn't try to do something about it. I tried to persuade Bella to turn the ship around before we got to Janus, and I tried to turn it around when we got here. I failed on both occasions, and you must believe that no one is sorrier for that than me. I know there are some of you who feel we should make another attempt, that we should turn back around, leave the slipstream and lose as much speed as we can. Believe me, there's a part of me that feels the same way, that maybe we should just try and see how far we get. But we can't do it. Deep Shaft screwed us, people. They knew we didn't have enough fuel to make it to Janus and back, but Paul Kagan wasn't going to let that stop him. They hacked into us, altered our fuel data, made it look as if we could do this, but we never could. Paul Kagan knew from the word go that this was a suicide mission, and he signed off on it knowing full well what would happen to us. Not just Paul, either, but everyone at Deep Shaft was a part of it. He didn't put this together on his own. Ask yourselves this. Do these sound like the kind of people likely to put time and money into a rescue operation? Not just any old rescue operation, but the most technically ambitious mission ever mounted in the system, one that will require a better, faster ship than anything currently sitting on anyone's drawing board, including the Chinese. And that ship would need to reach us before our last power supplies run dry. It isn't doable, people. No will in the world can save us now. But we're not going to die. Like I said, we didn't ask for this. But now we're in it. We might as well make the best of it. Bella dealt us a hand. It's a pretty shitty one, but we have to play it. We're staying with Janus. There'll be no further attempts to escape the slipstream. I've taken steps to ensure that the fusion engine can't run in cruise mode again. It'll keep giving us ship power, and we can use the fuel for Avenger and Crusader when we need them. But it'll never push Rockhopper again. That's the hand I'm dealing us. It says we have to stay here, no matter how difficult it gets, no matter how tempting the alternative might be. The alternatives will kill us. We're going to land on Janus. There's still a nice cap of water ice on the sternward face, and we should be safe there. No matter how fast Janus gets, we'll have 200 kilometers of shielding between us and the bow. That should be enough. We can live. We'll have power from the engine in the short term, so keeping warm won't be an issue. We'll have light and amenities. In the long run, we'll find a way to use Janus for power instead. But that isn't a bridge we have to cross tomorrow. We have closed-cycle waste recycling systems. We have aeroponics racks and zeolite beds. As long as that machinery keeps working, as long as the plants keep growing, we won't go hungry. We'll lose some water through the hull, but we can top up with Janus ice whenever we need to. We have enough medicine for the immediate future. Not enough to work miracles, but enough to keep most of us alive. We have centrifuges for gravity. We have landers and tractors and surface domes. We have robots. We have 50,000 tons of ship that deep shaft ain't getting back in one piece. Nat got a muted cheer that echoed around the ship. We dock Rockhopper with Janus just the way we dock a mass driver, dig a deep pit and line it with spray rock. Then we back the ship in, engine first, nice and easy. Then we'd better start learning to like Janus, because we're going to be here for a while. Svetlana's speech did not work miracles, but Bella had to concede that there was a subtle shift in the tension levels throughout the ship in the hours that followed. Minor rumbles of dissension were swiftly quashed. Svetlana had indeed taken a spanner, or more likely a teleoperated fist, to some delicate part of the fusion engine, rendering it unstable for sustained thrust. Bella wondered how much pain that act of tactical sabotage must have caused her. So Svieta had come round to Bella's point of view. In a perfect world, that would have been enough to let them see eye to eye again. But Bella knew better than that. It would take more than unity of purpose to heal the rift between them. "I wasn't expecting you," Bella said as Parry slid aside the compartment door. Parry removed his red cap and scratched his scalp. He looked dog-tired, waxy and unshaven, stress oozing from his pores. "Craig didn't want to talk to you," Parry said, and she picked up something in his words beyond the surface content of the statement. Bella thought of everything she knew about Craig Schrope, everything she knew about the type of man he was, and nodded. "Craig doesn't want to talk to anyone, does he?" "Craig's having a tough time adjusting," Parry said, "which isn't to say that it's exactly easy for the rest of us, but it'll be harder for Craig. Much, much harder. He's company to the marrow, Parry, but the company doesn't exist anymore. Not as far as we're concerned. It's just us and Rockhopper. Craig's little world is falling further away with every passing second. We're working without him. Maybe he'll come round. Maybe he won't. You never liked him or his kind. I'm just trying to find a way to run this ship. If Craig makes that easier, he'll become a part of it. If he doesn't, we'll manage without him. And where does Svetlana fit into this, or the other chiefs for that matter?" "You know who came with us and who didn't," Parry said, with no apparent rancor. "Right now Svetlana and I are running operations. We have the support of 2/3 of the crew, more or less."
"Two murderers amongst them?"
"They'll be dealt with." The way he said that scared her more than anything else. "You know I did everything in my power to prevent what happened. If you'd sided with me, Tom Crabtree wouldn't have had to do what he did. And if you'd listened to Svieta, we'd never have ended up where we are today. Let's not play the blame game, shall we?"
"Fine with me," Bella said. "What game would you rather play?"
"The one where we pull this ship together. The people who sided with Craig can run things for the time being. But we'll need everyone's help if we're to start looking beyond the next few weeks. That's why I need to start healing wounds. Beginning with me," Bella said. "I need something to appease the returners. Bring them back into the fold.
My head on a plate?"
"No," he said, but without the reflexive dismissal she had been expecting, as if her execution had at least been one possibility for discussion. "What we need," Parry stumbled, and was suddenly unable to meet her eyes. "You're going to stay here until we're down.
I'll make sure you're kept comfortable in better conditions than you've been in for the last day. I'm hearing a but. You won't be allowed contact with anyone. The only people you'll speak to will be me and someone from the medical section.
I need to talk to Sveta,
Bella said urgently. She doesn't want to talk to you ever again. This ship needs me, Parry. I know I've burnt our friendship, but this is about more than that. I'll submit to Sveta's authority if that keeps her happy. But give me enough power to make a difference. Give me enough to help. You've been deposed, Bella. The way Sveta sees it, you blew critical command decisions when there was still time to make things right. You took us deeper into the incident pit when we could still have climbed out. Deeper and deeper until the sides were too steep. I also saved this damned crew from a slow death in deep space. Doesn't that count for something? That's by the by. I expected better of you, Parry. This is the best you're going to get. I'm sorry, Bella. This isn't exactly a picnic for any of us. It's not as if we'll be partying it up while you're locked away. We'll be surviving, that's all. You'll have the easier time of it, frankly. Look into my eyes and say that. He shook his head, not looking her way. When the ship's down, when we've established some kind of stable presence on Janus, you'll be taken away somewhere. Svetlana doesn't want you around anymore. Svetlana sat in Bella's old office, wondering what she should do with the fish. For now, she fed them as best she could, and ignored their dim, accusatory expressions, the way their constantly working mouths seemed to whisper conspiracies. The ship was quieter now than it had been in weeks, and for the most part the crew had come round to her authority. They were even calling it the interim authority. It had nothing to do with deep shaft and everything to do with survival. Pushing forward, breath by breath, inch by inch, no matter what it took. Saul Regis knocked on the open door. A Lind loyalist, Regis had never needed persuading that Janus was their only hope of survival. But the death of Crabtree had touched him on some emotional register Svetlana had barely recognized in him before. "They're going to pay," Parry told me.
"Yes," she said,
and it was true. The two men were in custody. No matter what else happened, they would never see Earth again. Regis pushed a flexi across to her.
"Then it has to be done properly."
"Properly, Saul." He scratched at his gut through the thin fabric of his sweatshirt. "You can't just do it to them. There have to be words. There has to be a ceremony. We're miners, Saul. No one gave us the book on capital law. Then we have to make our own book. No waiting for instructions from home. This has to be something we do. Communities make law. We need law. Some kind of judicial apparatus." Something about his presence made Svetlana shiver, and she looked down at the flexi with dread. A static frame filled the image window. A group of figures crowded around a campfire in some weirdly lit desert landscape, with a cloud-streaked pink sky and too many moons. The figures wore body-hugging costumes and kinky boots, with lots of equipment and weapons hanging from their belts, sleekly molded in matte silver. Their hairstyles and makeup were meant to look futuristic, but actually looked 20 or 30 years out of date. One man knelt by the campfire while another pointed a weapon at the side of his head. Next to the man with a gun, a tall, black-clad, clerical-looking alien read from a kind of scroll.
"Fuck, Saul," she said, as recognition clicked in. "This is
Cosmic Avenger," he said, before she had a chance to continue. "Season 4, Episode 5. Avenger drops through a plenum gash into the unmapped zone, out of range of Terrafleet communications. With the ship damaged, Lieutenant Tybald attempts to seize control from Captain Underhill."
"Saul," she said softly, as if speaking to a sleepwalker. "Saul, this is just a TV show. A bad TV show from my childhood, which no one even took seriously back then."
She handed back the flexi with a shudder of distaste.
"This is not some kind of life manual. What are you actually suggesting? That we all start acting as if we believe that this is real?"
"The execution scene's an acknowledged classic," Regis said. "The writing in that fourth season arc. Underhill's speech at the execution. I know a lot of people think Star Crusader was better, but it really wasn't. Of course, they'll never understand that." She kept waiting for Regis to blink,
to show some indication that this was at best a sick joke at an inappropriate time, but there was no crack in that mask of sincerity. She tried again.
"You really think this speech?"
"I'm not saying copy it word for word." He shook his head as if that was absurd. "It's just that when Underhill said what he said, how things were looking for the crew, how Underhill knew what she had to do but regretted having to do it all the same, the template of it." He trailed off, with the air of someone who thought that they had made their point convincingly enough.
"We could do a lot worse."
"I'm sure we could," she said. "Thank you for the input, Saul. Now please, get out of my office." He pressed the flexi to his chest, where it softened to bend itself around him.
"I just think it needs to be done right," he said, "for Tom Crabtree."
She watched him leave, aghast at what had taken place, but not entirely surprised by it either. For some of her crew, the knowledge that they were now prisoners of Janus was already a kind of death. She knew, with an acute sense of precognition, that there would be suicides in the times that lay ahead. She thought she could predict with some accuracy who would choose that option too. But for a tiny minority, Janus would be a kind of liberation. The old world, with its bewildering emotional and political complexities, was receding. What lay ahead would be simpler and more emblematic. Just as some people lived a kind of half-life until a war came along, at which point they flourished, so the austere simplicities of Janus might be attractive to a man like Saul Regis, a slate wiped brutally clean. He had been gone a long time before Svetlana picked up her own flexi and navigated Shipnet, looking for the same ancient media files Regis must have already mined. She had no intention of copying the words of the execution. The very thought revolted her. But there could be no harm in simply looking at what had happened. Could there? Preparations for the mating of Janus and Rockhopper swallowed days. Svetlana dreamed multicolored simulations and woke from fevered hours of stress analysis in which numbers and equations had battled like epic protagonists. Once Rockhopper was down, there would be no way of lifting it from Janus again. Gravity on Janus was a feeble 350 times weaker than on Earth. A person weighed next to nothing. But a 50,000-ton space vehicle still needed 150 tons of thrust to lift itself aloft, which was a lot more than the steering and station-keeping motors could supply. Even using the landers as tugs, Rockhopper would come in hard, punching down into the pit with all the force of a skyscraper-sized battering ram. The stress analysis said the ship would hold together, but the computations were mind-numbingly complex, and an error anywhere, however tiny, could mean doom. As the car took her back to the hab, her flexi chimed unexpectedly. With her head swimming with engineering issues, she had asked not to be called unnecessarily. She pulled the flexi from her jacket, shook it alive, and found herself looking at Denise Nadis.
"You need to see this, I think," Nadis said.
"What?" Svetlana asked.
"We were looking at Janus, at the ice cap, mapping it with the high-res cameras, looking for alternative dig sites. I thought we'd agreed on the site. Haven't we already got machines down there?"
Nadis blinked and swallowed. "I just wanted to be sure we'd pick the best spot. Once we're down..."
"I know. No second chances. What is it, Denise?"
"We found this." An image box swelled to cover most of Nadis's face. At first, Svetlana could make nothing of the mesh of false-color hexels overlaid with numeric codes.
"You're going to have to help me, Denise."
"I'm sorry. Zoom's too far out. This is a section of the ice cap, about 50 clicks south of where we're planning to dig. That's the limit of our search area. It was just luck that we happened to find it at all."
"Find what?"
Nadis whispered a command to her own flexi. The image swelled and zoomed until Svetlana was clearly looking down at something blunt and metallic, mashed into the ice as if it had hit at high speed.
"It's a ship," Nadis said. "Part of one, anyway."
A scale overlay dropped over the image. The crashed ship was only 20 meters across its longest axis.
"That's not right," Svetlana said flatly. "We already mapped the ice at enough res not to have missed..."
"We didn't miss shit," Nadis interrupted her. She was on firm ground now. "It wasn't there before. It must have come in since we completed the maps. Slipped right past us somehow."
"While we were otherwise engaged," Svetlana said, understanding.
The ship's form was familiar to her, albeit as part of a larger whole. She had seen the television pictures from Earth orbit. It was part of the Shenzhou 5.
This is impossible. We destroyed it. We shot it out of the fucking sky.
We're only looking at part of it, Svetlana said, like the smallest part of a multi-staged rocket. They must have planned on using one large fusion engine and fuel tank to get them out here, and then returning home using a smaller stage, with its own engine and fuel.
It's tiny.
I know. Maybe they weren't carrying as many people as they wanted us to believe.
Nadis still sounded spooked, as if the reappearance of the Chinese ship violated some fundamental principle of her personal universe.
What the hell happened, though? Bella shot at it. Nothing changes that.
Maybe Bella just damaged it, Svetlana said. Cooked their main stage with the FAD, forced them to bail out into the second stage and make a run for it.
Run here?
Maybe they didn't have a hell of a lot of choice.
If that thing was built to take them home, why didn't they use it?
I'm guessing maybe because they had too much velocity in the wrong direction, Svetlana said. They must have intended to use the main stage to slow down before they started their return journey.
Only Bella cancelled that option.
Looks like it. Wang must have known he had one shot at being rescued, and that was us.
Oh, Jesus. You mean he was trying to catch up with Rockhopper?
I think so.
After we shot the poor kid out of the sky.
Beggars can't be choosers, Denise.
Trouble is, he didn't know about the slipstream either.
He must have used up all his fuel, Nadis said. Never had enough to slow down.
But even as Nadis voiced the thought, Svetlana knew she was wrong. If the Shenzhou 5 had come in at uncontrolled speed, there would only be a crater where the ship now lay. For the ship to have survived at all, for the ship not to have smeared itself across the whole face of Janus, the crash must have been very close to a landing. It must have been very close to survivable.
There could be something alive in that thing, she said.
There isn't, Nadis said. No transponder, no SOS beacon. We've tried hailing on the Chinese frequency. Nothing.
Wang can't have died. You don't come all this way, make it this far and just die.
They're dead, Svieta. I just thought you needed to know. Maybe there's some tech we can use.
Get me infrared, she said.
We've tried it. She's still hot. But if she'd come in from space in the last week or so, we'd expect her to be.
I still want infrared, Svetlana said, and I don't want to have to ask a third time.
Nadis made a huffing sound that she probably hoped Svetlana didn't catch. It was going to be tough for Nadis from now on, taking orders from someone who had been her equal in the old regime. But she was good. She would learn. So they turned the cams on Shenzhou 5, as they had turned cannons on it before, and this time they took a series of mid-infrared snapshots. When they scrolled onto Svetlana's flexi, they had the hyperreal clarity of images taken across a perfect and still vacuum. The ship was still hot, just as Nadis had told her it would be. Engine parts glowed in cherry-red false color as they ticked and cooled down to Janus ambient, but there was a pattern to the radiating heat that made Svetlana's heart jump in her chest. The radiator sketched a neon grid across the exposed surface of the hull, but only there. The visible side panels were dark, so, judging by the lack of boil-off, were the under panels.
"He's still alive," she said excitedly. "He's turned off the radiators in contact with the ice. If he didn't, he'd melt his way right down to the machinery. Machines wouldn't have done that. It must have taken human intervention after the ship came to rest."
"Why didn't he send us a message?" Nadis asked.
"He did," Svetlana said. "That was it."
They went down in Cosmic Avenger and hovered near the smashed wreck of the Shenzhou 5, sending out robots to scout it from different angles. It looked bad at first, but that was only because every fragile part of the ship had been bent or broken off by the glancing impact. The airtight hull had weathered the crash with only a slight amount of buckling. Even in the optical, its heat radiators were visible as brick-red squiggles along its dorsal surface. There were no windows in the pale green metal, no way to tell if the crew was alive or dead. Avenger touched down nearby. Robots scouted again, poking and prodding the snow-bound hull for a way in. The Chinese used a simplified variant of the same rocketed airlock door design as everyone else. But from the outside, there was no way to tell whether a particular door really was an airlock, and not just a door leading straight into a pressurized cabin. They had to bring in an emergency outer airlock sheath from Avenger and glue it into place with dabs of fast-setting vacuum epoxy. They sealed it with a cork of spray rock, then pumped it full of Trimix, adjusted to their best guess for the Chinese taste in pressure and gas fraction. Even the best airlock made settling sounds as pressure equalized on either side of it. With his helmet resting against the door, Parry heard these sounds like distant hammer taps. It told him there was probably air on the other side. He knocked on the door. He waited and knocked again, knowing that a survivor might need time to complete final suiting-up procedures before working the lock. Even in a hurry, that might take 5 or 6 minutes. He knocked again and waited. 5 minutes, then 10. He gave it 15 to be on the safe side. There was no rush, given how long the Chinese had been down there already. But still no one was coming. Parry swung the door open using the manual release. They'd been right about the Trimix, and although they'd also been right to be careful, there was an airlock chamber on the other side. Good omens. Maybe his knocks hadn't been audible through all those layers of metal and insulation. He opened the inner door and stepped inside. It was crypt dark. Another braille dive. But when he cuffed on his helmet light, he saw all that he needed to. The ship was a wreck. A dislodged pile of equipment and furniture had been compacted into the nose under the force of the impact. Hull spars were sheared off like broken ribs. The Chinese were good at materials science, everyone knew that, but this ship had taken more of a kicking than even they built for. Parry poked the torch into the rubble, wincing against what he expected to find, a brave crewman pinned into his seat, mangled into something that would give him nightmares for the rest of his life. But there was no one there. He directed the light towards the back of the ship and saw a bulkhead door, framed on either side by Chinese symbols. He picked his way through the wreckage and knocked on the door. He waited, but again there was no answer. No telling if there was air on the other side, or just a vacuum pocket. If it was vacuum, the door would swing away from him as soon as he unlocked the catches. He braced himself against the possible outrush of air and worked the release. The door opened easily, without snatching away from his fingers. He shone the light inside, and the beam picked out a Chinese man wearing lightweight clothes. He lay on his back on a heavily padded couch, facing the rear of the ship. He was strapped in like a psychiatric patient, tied down with enormous cushioned restraints. One of his arms was bent at an odd, anatomically problematic angle. His eyes were closed, the lids blackened. He looked dead. Parry moved towards the man and leaned in close, until his faceplate glass was only a finger's width from the man's mouth. A faint smear of exhaled breath misted the glass. "Ryan," Parry said, "you'd better get over here. There's a survivor. He looks pretty beaten up." "What about the others?" Axford asked. "There are no others, just this one man. Just this one kid." The man's eyes opened. They were red through the black slits of his lids. G-force hemorrhaging, the eyes bleeding from inside as they were squeezed out of shape. He must have heard Parry speaking through his helmet. The man started to move a limb, then aborted the motion. Pain creased his face. "Easy, easy," Parry said. He reached up and undid his helmet seal, unconcerned that he might be placing himself at risk. He lifted off the helmet and let it drift down to the floor. "It's Wang, right?" The man's lips moved. They were dry and very chapped. In a ghost of a voice he said, "Commander Wang Zhanmin." "Parry Boyce," he said, "from the Rockhopper. Welcome to Janus."
"I think I may have broken something in the crash," Wang said weakly.
"There's a doctor coming over. We'll take care of you. You're going to be fine."
"Where will you take me?"
"Back to Rockhopper," Parry said.
"There's something you need to do first, before you leave the Shenzhou 5, where it is, before she melts into the ice."
Wang lifted a finger, pointing to the back of the ship.
"In the rear compartment, I brought something for you."
"You brought us something?" Wang managed a nod.
"I thought it might come in useful. There was just time to transfer it before I had to undock. Consider it a gift from China."
Parry landed Avenger on minimum thrust, kicking up only a tiny backwash of boiled ice. He emerged from the ship wearing a hard-shell Orlan. Elias Feldman, Hank Dussen, and Gillian Shimozu followed him, escorting two bound prisoners who were wearing softer spacesuits of older design. They progressed across the ice in gentle parabolas until they were about 100 meters from the lander. They had arrived at a spot of ground roughly 10 meters across, illuminated with a disc of projected laser light from the distant form of rockhopper. The circle was as sharply edged as if it had been marked with chalk. The shadows were black and judicial, as dark as the interstellar night itself. Parry brought the little party to a halt in the middle of the circle. The bound prisoners were made to kneel on the ice, shoulder to shoulder, while Feldman, Dussen, and Shimozu stood behind. Parry stood before them, his legs slightly apart for balance. He peeled a flexi from the chest of his suit, where it had been drinking power. With a flick of his wrist, the flexi stiffened itself until it had the rigidity of slate. He held the flexi to the level of his helmet, tilting it this way and that until he found the right angle. The words he had prepared were marked in bold type. His voice came from every wall and flexi on rockhopper. At first his words were hesitant, but as he continued to speak he seemed to find some wellspring of authority within himself. John Chanticleer and Connor Herrick, you have been brought here to face punishment for the death of Thomas Crabtree 8 days ago. You were found guilty of this crime by a jury of your fellow crewmen. Parry waited for the flexi to scroll to the next block of text. The hesitation seemed to lend the proceedings even more solemnity. The judicial apparatus of the interim authority has determined that murder must be punished by death. There were 144 of us before you killed Tom Crabtree. Now there will be 141. Let your deaths mark an end to this. Let your deaths not go wasted. After this day, there will be no more killing. He stopped again and looked up from the brightly lit tableau to the hovering ship most of them would see again. We will heal our differences or die together. Parry lowered the flexi. Let the sentence be enacted. Hank Dussen and Elias Feldman stationed themselves on either side of John Chanticleer. Gillian Shimozu removed a cumbersome piece of mining equipment from her belt, a recoilless hammer drill. A ribbed power line ran from the drill to her backpack. She held the drill two-handed and pressed its sharpened, glinting tip against the back of Chanticleer's helmet. With the thumb of her right hand, she armed the drill's magnetic induction coils. Pink status lights flickered along the drill's barrel. The drill had been buffed to a high sheen. Parry knelt down so that his helmet was level with the faceplate of John Chanticleer. No one else knew it, but the trimix of the condemned men had been adjusted before they stepped from the descent craft. They were drunk on oxygen, stoned and slightly euphoric. "This will be quick and painless," Parry said, while doubting that either of them heard him. Then he looked over the crest of Chanticleer's helmet and nodded to Gillian Shimozu. She fired the hammer drill. It flinched in her grip, but the counteracting weights held it steady, even as the mass of the sharpened cutting tip rammed its way through the back of Chanticleer's helmet on a ripple of magnetic induction. The helmet's self-sealing layer ensured that there was only a cough of air loss before the helmet regained integrity. By then the drill had done its work. Something vile coated the inner surface of Chanticleer's faceplate. Shimozu jerked the drill free. The tip was stained red. She knelt down and drove it into the ice until the friction worked it clean. Chanticleer stayed in the kneeling position, held there by Hank Dussen. Feldman moved to Herrick and placed a hand on his right shoulder. They repeated the process. When Shimozu had removed the drill for the second time and cleaned the blade, she took a respectful step back from the two men she had just executed. Parry nodded and the men released their holds on Chanticleer and Herrick. With a horrid, almost comic, synchrony, the two kneeling figures pitched forward in slow motion and buried their faceplates in the ice. Part 2. 2059 plus.